Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 104 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, novelist and non-fiction writer Miranda Miller works to finish a novel, visits an exhibition related to an old one, and considers whether she wants to be a brand in the brave new world of 21st century publishing. Following Miranda, we featured two entertaining pieces from the Vox section of our website. First up, here's Miranda Miller with My Writing Week.
Monday. That's Janáček, one of my favourite composers. I listen to music a lot, but never when I'm writing. I write in the mornings, which sounds more disciplined than it is, because my morning might start any time between 5 and 10. This morning, I woke up at 8, came downstairs in my dressing gown, had breakfast, and I've just staggered into the study, which overlooks our autumnal North London garden. All this week, I'm going to be struggling with the end of my 8th novel. My publisher phoned yesterday to say that it's going in their catalogue, which means I have to finish it by mid-December at the latest. I work slowly and rewrite a lot. It's been very difficult to find an ending for the third volume of my Bedlam trilogy, which is called King of the Vast. It's a doppelganger novel about the 19th century apocalyptic painter John Martin and his brother Jonathan, who set fire to York Minster because God told him to. I always find endings very hard to write, and towards the end of a novel, I lie awake, worrying, and wake up at strange hours with wrong notes I've hit booming in my head. The end of a trilogy is particularly difficult. Each of these three novels is self-contained, linked by the themes of art and madness and time travel. Somehow, I have to tie all three together without making the bow so neat that it looks gift-wrapped and slick. I've just had an email from a marketing company offering me a free consultation. It says, "We believe that having a clear brand and a tidy approach makes it easier to communicate that idea to others." Well, it's very nice of them, but do I want to be a brand? Tuesday. I woke up at 5:30 and couldn't get back to sleep, so I've come downstairs to the study with a cup of green tea and a bowl of cereal, and I've turned on my desktop computer, which hums comfortingly into life. I turn off my emails and my phone. I love this silent early morning time, waiting for it to get light in the garden. Although this is my 8th novel, it often feels like my first. I still feel the same mixture of impatience to finish it and reluctance to expose it to readers. Always this fear that I've forgotten something vital, like in a nightmare when you have to go on stage but you don't know your lines. I'm reading the manuscript of a novel sent to me by the Literary Consultancy. I have to write a long report on it. It's so much easier to see what's wrong with other people's novels than with my own. I've been working for them for about 8 years now as a reader and mentor, and I find it really interesting. It's all done by email, so I don't meet the authors and probably wouldn't feel able to be so honest if I did. I often expect the authors of the manuscripts to be furious about my comments and perhaps turn up on my doorstep waving an axe. But in fact, most people are glad to have their work criticised in what is, I hope, a constructive spirit. Wednesday. This morning I worked on my novel and then spent a lot of time writing a talk I'm giving next week at St Catherine's College, Oxford. They've asked me to talk about a book of interviews I wrote, my first and last non-fiction book. It was published in 1990 by the Women's Press, which no longer exists. My book is called Bed and Breakfast, Women and Homelessness Today. That today was insisted on by my editor, and it looks rather silly now. It will feel odd to be talking about such an old book. I've forgotten what I wrote and have to read it again as if it was by somebody else. Sadly, homelessness is much worse now than it was 25 years ago. Thursday. I'm very nearly at the end of my novel, but I'm going to have to write yet another draft. There are lots of little notes scribbled to myself to remind me of a long list of things I've left out or need to expand or cut. I go on and on rewriting until I know it so well that I'm sick to death of it and just can't read it anymore. Which doesn't, of course, mean that I finished it, just that it has finished me. I've just had an email from Penn asking members to send messages demanding the release of the journalist, Mohammed Ismail Rasool, who's been charged with working on behalf of a terrorist organisation and is still detained in Turkey. I send emails to the Turkish ambassador and the Minister of Justice, asking them to release him. Such excellencies never, of course, reply to insignificant worms like me, but there's always the hope that if they get enough emails, it will shame them into either treating a prisoner better or letting him go, or letting her go. I sit in the study, looking out at our peaceful garden, and wonder what's happening to Mohammed. Friday. Today, Gordon and I took a day off and went to see the Richard Dadd exhibition at Compton, near Guildford. Dadd was the main character in my last novel, The Fairy Visions of Richard Dadd. It was quite a schlep to get there from London by train and bus, but I'm very glad we did. The G.F. Watts Gallery is in an interesting complex of arts and crafts buildings set in a lush area of rural Surrey. G.F. Watts was a grand old man of Victorian art who was born the same year as the Parricide outsider artist Richard Dadd in 1817. Watts was successful and led a glamorous life, whereas Richard Dadd was imprisoned in Bedlam and later Broadmoor from the age of 26, and nobody except a few doctors saw his work in his lifetime. Yet now, at least in my eyes, the work of Watts looks bloated and dated, whereas Dadd's mysterious paintings look fresh and timeless. It's an excellent exhibition, with details projected onto a wall and a screen of the tiny, obsessive intricacies of Dadd's best paintings, The Fairy Fella's Masterstroke and Contradiction. Dadd's fairies are wonderfully nasty and sinister, hidden among the cobnuts, wild flowers and conkers of the Kentish landscape where he grew up. It's fascinating, too, to see the original manuscript of The Elimination of a Picture and its Subject, called The Fella's Masterstroke. This is the long poem that Dadd wrote to accompany his extraordinary painting. written in beautiful copperplate, most of it's confused and rambling, although it does have one magnificent verse, which I stole for the ending of my novel. But whether it be or be not so, you can afford to let this go, for naught as nothing it explains, and nothing from nothing, nothing gains. Like the great painting, it certainly doesn't explain or eliminate. This strange poem is imbued with secrecy and mystery. And I was very pleased to see that copies of my novel were in the shop, so I signed them so that they can't be sent back to the publisher. Saturday. This morning, the novel feels a bit easier. Perhaps we needed a break from each other. I think I can finish it later this month. Steinbeck said, I sit here in a stupor and call it thought. I do have to go into a kind of trance to be able to see and hear my characters. While I'm writing about them, I have to suspend my own disbelief. Otherwise, how can I expect anyone else to believe my story? It's a sort of self-hypnosis and very addictive. In the afternoon, I go to meet the sympathetic young woman from the marketing agency for coffee. We talk about the conflicts between private and public, introvert and extrovert, fantasy and reality, solitude and sociability, which seem to have driven my life as a writer. She suggests some websites that might be useful as forums or places where I could blog, and she also gives me advice on updating my own website and linking it with others. The idea is to claim that it's all one body of work. It is, of course, but my first novel was published in 1978, and publishing has changed enormously since then, and so have I. It's helpful to have a guide through the mysteries of literary cyberspace. Sunday. I've started to think about the next novel, which will be about the art world in Rome and London in the 18th and very early 19th century. This came largely out of my experience at the Courtauld, where I was a RLF fellow for 2 years, ending in May, and I had the run of the library there. So being there was very helpful as well as very enjoyable. I've got lots of notes for the next novel, but no clear plan yet. I start a novel when I can hear the voices of my main characters, and I can't hear them yet.
That was Miranda Miller. You can find out more about Miranda on her website at www.mirandamiller.info. Next, we're delighted to feature two pieces from Letter to My Younger Self from the Vox section of Showcase on our website. Our two correspondents are poet and critic John Greening and non-fiction writer Mary Colson.
Dear John, if I could quickly catch your attention as you skip out of Miss Davis's study looking so pleased with yourself. She obviously enjoyed your poem about Jehoshaphat Jim and Jehoshaphat Joe, although she might have pointed out how much it owed to Mr. Lear. I'd like to give you some of the advice I never had. You're only in junior school now, so it's a good time to hear it, and there'll be disappointments when you move up. Your teachers won't want to put on your first play, Harold Iaeneas, a political satire. They'll be too busy, unbelievably. And that prize essay of yours will never win one because of its clichés. You'll wince for the next half century whenever something is selling like hot cakes. Admittedly, a teasing geography field trip piece in the school mag is going to win you some admirers, rain, rain and moraine. But what's the point since it's an all-boys school? You seem to be doing pretty well this side of puberty. Mum's Woman's Weekly will clear that up for you. But I want to say, keep at it. There's this grown-up American called Malcolm Gladwell who reckons that everything worth doing requires 10,000 hours to bring to perfection. Though it's probably not what you want to hear as you're running home to Zedcars. For now, it's all fishing rods and conjuring tricks, and very soon you'll think of nothing but cinefilm. But that's fine. Those things are also teaching you how to write. And you do write, don't you? True, your diaries tend to trail off around March after your birthday presents. But what about those days you sat pounding the old Underwood? Crash, crash, crash was your opening line. Or haven't you started it yet? Keep a carbon copy or two. It's the one about building a time machine, where you called out to Dad for a really remote and atmospheric place to set it in. Why did he say Cobham Common? What I should be telling you is, read the classics. Steep yourself in poetry that will stay with you for the rest of your life. Like Terry Waite, who was, well, he was stuck in a fridge for a long time in Lebanon with nothing to read. But I think you're reading enough, because you have so many interests, and they require books. Donald Featherstone on war games, Patrick Moore's Observer's Book of Astronomy, The Right Way to Keep Pet Fish, The Right Way to Catch Them with Mr. Crabtree. You're still working your way through the Boy's Own Book of Hobbies, aren't you? I recall you won it for sending in that news item. The fire in Manchester was described as a clear case of arson by the chief constable. Your sister spotted it. You won the book. An ear for a witty line and an eye for the main chance. You probably haven't quite reached the model theatre chapter yet. There's so much to try your hand at. And you don't even have the internet. I'll explain that in the next letter. Still to come, flying saucers and card fortune-telling. The Book of Fate you found at the Fate, with a heap of wordplay. Palmistry, phrenology. As for poetry, it'll be a while before you improve on the Jehoshaphats. Best wishes for the future. John.
Dear Tuffet, lying on the sofa daydreaming again? Or are you staring from your bedroom window at the old folks' home across the road and hoping that the whistler will make another break for it through the gate between the scary trees? He made it all the way to buy razor blades at the kiosk at the Golden Lantern last week before he was caught, didn't he? Oh yes, I know you. I know what you're doing. I know how you're thinking. You're 9 years old, it's the summer holidays, and you're bored. Mum keeps telling you to go outside and play, but you don't want to. There's no one around to practice Eurovision dance routines with or to play Monopoly. You watched Moonraker on VHS yesterday, and the boys won't let you play tennis with them because you lose too many balls in the field. So you're listening and watching and waiting for something to come along. In your head, you're making a list of things you're going to do when you're a grown-up. It's hard to write this next bit, but you're not going to be a stunt woman. I know you think you're going to be the female Lee Majors, but you ain't, kiddo. Neither will you win an Olympic medal, even at the walk. What you will do is try various haircuts, from the Meg Ryan to the Rachel. You'll know them when the time comes. But despite your best efforts, nature will win, and you'll ultimately be back to where you started, with a Kate Humble frizz. She's on the telly when you're older. Stay on the sofa long enough and she'll tell you all about birds and animals. A bit like Johnny Morris, only sometime into the next century they let girls know stuff too. More importantly, by the time you turn 30, I know, old, right? Your CV will be like one of Mrs. Bailey's lessons on verbs. You will have packed, cleared, cleaned, served, polished, buffed, kimballed, waitressed, shepherded, painted, dressed, acted, prepared, taught, glued, selected, edited, sorted, delivered, changed, fed, watered, played, decorated, harvested. And you will still spend your time watching and listening, sometimes from the sofa and sometimes out in a cafe. I know there aren't any of those in Oni, are there? It's like a really small service station, like the one you stop at on the way to Grandma's. No, you don't take your own sandwiches and flask, and you don't pinch the sugar. I can't tell you that when you're a grown-up you're going to be a writer, because you are already one. You're doing the groundwork right now. You don't know it yet, but you're soaking it all up, taking it all in. A hard-of-hearing father is teaching you that there's more than one way to listen. A linguistic mother is showing you the beauty of words. Even the boys are helping you to understand that people are a crazy mix of contradiction. I know they annoy you, but let me tell you, those years spent sitting in the hole in the hedge, keeping guard over HQ as they ran around playing soldiers, have made you patient. Don't think that writers know everything, and don't worry about forgetting stuff. They don't, and you won't. You remember all the things you need. The bread and bits and banana sandwich Sunday teas. Drying your hair by the gas fire and Dad polishing your school shoes. The telling off you got for sneaking out to the fair because you told your mum that Vicky's mum was going to be there. And she wasn't, was she? Your teddy being stolen from your bicycle basket in Suffolk. Walking up Snowdon age 6 only to find out you had to walk back down again. Putting KW's bicycle into a clump of stinging nettles after her sustained bullying campaign. You felt empowered for approximately 4 minutes before you realised you had to pass her house and her glaring mother on the way back to your own. Your beautiful white faux fur coat, with a diamante zip no less, being ruined when you slipped, fell, were pushed into your grandfather's fishing pond. You'll never forget that coat and its transformation from fluffy duckling to slithy tove. Gangster chic at 3 years old. Be glad for it, though. It's all going to come in use. And don't worry about growing up and things changing. All those real-life people you're watching, from the sofa, from the window, from the hedge. Mr. Lack, the caretaker, and his Robin Rialto. Milky Davis and his snotty son. Athol Barrick, who lost half a finger trying to land a pike. So he said. John the Con, who sells maggots and has a lazy eye. Alfie Sizer, the beekeeper, and Alfie Harrison, who only eats burnt bread. Mr. Pebbedy, who smells of the tan. Ratty Andrews, who smokes roll-ups at the allotments. Jeremiah Richardson, who you'd love to play kiss chase with. Mr. Morgan, who shouts on Poppy Day. Sister Mary at the convent, who keeps quail and speaks in a really funny accent. Miss Smith, who you also call Auntie Daphne, but who's no relation to you whatsoever. You'll never get this, just go with. Dustbin and Jelly in the Dagnall Road lot. Even the Whistler, who murders people and puts them in his wheelbarrow. You're going to meet them all again when you grow up. They might not look or act quite the same, but you know who they are. I'm writing this from the middle of your fifth decade. You'll know by the time you get here that life can go pear-shaped. You'll have had your heart broken and your spirits crushed, but you'll have also been filled with joy and energised by experience. You'll know that writing can be like herding cats, and that good writing can be like hen's teeth. If, at the end of a draft, you think it's a curate's egg, consider that a success. Don't expect the moon and the stars, but go boldly into the space. You'll be told that mixing metaphors is not the done thing. Au contraire, my friend. You weren't raised to follow convention, be tribal, or nail your colours to any mast, so write freely. You'll know when it's time to start. For now, keep watching. Keep listening. See you around, Tuffet.
That was John Greening and Mary Colson with Letter to My Younger Self. You can find out more about John and Mary on the RLF website, where you can also listen to many other recordings in the Vox section of our online showcase. And that concludes episode 104, which was recorded by Miranda Miller and the Vox team and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 105, the novelist Jane Rogers tells George Miller about how her writing career began, about writing novels versus short stories, and the impact of suffering a brain hemorrhage. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.